Welcome back, Beyonders, to Tabletop and Beyond. I am your host, Jason.
And I'm Justin.
Hey! Dang it. I read your name just as I was saying my own. It's Mix'em Up Match'em Up Day today. Yay! Welcome to the show, everybody. We are going to talk today about how to make D&D great again. You know, it's a conversation that has kind of come up. We've been playing D&D and, you know, like we've been playing a lot of other RPG systems and D&D is a classic, right? Like there's a lot of great things about it. And I don't know, like sometimes it just feels like it's lost its love and feeling and, you know, bring back that love and feeling. That's what we're going to talk about today. How do we bring back that love and feeling of D&D? So, we're excited to have you all with us today. We're excited for you to join this journey with us. And we're going to kick it off with Geek Week. Jason, how's your Geek Week, buddy?
Yeah, good. So first off, let me share my screen here, actually. I'm going to ask for permission here. No. So I've been testing my skills at 3D rendering here, which is fun, right? So Blender is a free tool. So when you're ready, there we go. Yep. So I followed Blender Guru's donut tutorial. So he updated it probably about four and 6 months for a Blender 4.0. So I've always kind of doinked around with Blender here and there over the years just to do fun stuff. And I said, I want to make something that looks way more realistic than just these kind of like polygony dinosaurs and stuff. And so I followed this tutorial to really understand like lighting and everything. So, you know, we went through the process of making these donuts from scratch, just from an individual polygon, putting materials on them and eventually rendering them. So, I had a lot of fun, learn. And obviously this is not actually the render. This is like if you could believe it, this is a lower resolution than the final image that gets produced. But man, I mean, you learn so much about like lighting and, you know, stylistic setting. Interesting. Like this all thing, like you make a virtual light box.
Okay.
For your scene. Like you see my little camera there?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you get your camera set up, you get kind of the thing you want, you get your backdrop, and then you make this light box, and then Blender actually emulates the sun. Like the sun is right there. You see it?
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
And so that sun is coming through this box.
Through the window there.
Yes, right? You kind of set the window based on how you want the light. And then this wall right here is made specifically to absorb it so you don't get the bounce reflection. And then you put all sorts of like additional light sources. Like there's a light source right there that's giving a little light from that angle. So I can really kind of control. So, and then I just, you know, you can zoom right into the light box. You can see that extra light source I have just to put a little bit of light here.
Yep.
So learned a lot about, and I'm thinking, man, this could really help me like take better pictures of minis and stuff. With understanding like the right places to kind of put the lights and stuff. So, and it's, I mean, gosh, it's just, this is a free tool that has a lot of community support, but it's just really, really, really good. Like, you know, you can see if I rotate, I can rotate the sun around. You see the shadows?
Oh, that's really cool. It's almost like a time lapse right now.
Yeah. And then I can change the elevation of the sun depending on like what time of day it is.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much flexibility in what you can do with this tool. So I spent, it probably took me a solid week of doing like, you know, an hour to an hour and a half every night from scratch to get to this state. So 1 week, Blender Guru's tutorial really teaches you how to do it. And since then I've worked around with some other things. Like my wife said, hey, let's look at our office. Like, how could we redo our office? And I said, well, I could model it up. And she kind of gave me this smirk like, okay, go ahead and try to model up the office. And I said, all right. And so she came home one night and I modeled up like our full office space.
Nice.
And said, you know, it's the exact shape of my office. So that she could see, where do we put the bookshelves? Where do we move things around? Where does the desk go? And she comes in and looks at this. She goes, oh my gosh, it looks just like your desk. It looks just like the bookshelves from IKEA that we have, you know?
Yeah.
Everything. She's like, well, but could you put doors on the bookshelves? I said, well, absolutely. I could put doors on the bookshelves, you know?
And nice. So
I put the doors with the windows. Sorry, I've zoomed in a little bit, but yeah. So really awesome tool. And not only did I use it fun to make some fake donuts, but I also used it to figure out how we want to redo our office. So my daughter says, hey dad, I want to make some donuts. So I told her and she made a big plate with a pile of donuts on it. So anyways, that was the majority of my geek week right there. So a lot of fun, using, open source tools, totally free. And Blender Guru, right? He makes a living teaching Blender, but the tutorial is like a full soup to nuts free tutorial to get started. He even gives you some of his textures and materials to use.
Did you get it off of Udemy?
No. So Blender Guru uses YouTube. So all of his stuff.
Oh, okay.
I do have some training, some older Blender stuff from YouTube. But honestly, I think I learned a lot more just using Blender Guru on YouTube than the old stuff I had on Udemy. Now the dungeon actually, since I'll just keep the mic here for a second. Let me see if I can pull up my dungeon. Yeah, here we go. Let me share the screen again here. I wish it was like one button to share screen. I have to click like five things just to share.
I know, five things.
It's ridiculous. So I did follow I had on Udemy to create all of these assets where I created kind of these walls, little nicks and bruises, you know, the different columns, some extra column, whoops, some barrels you can see back there, a torch. Some crates and gave them kind of, you know, some character, right? With the nicks and stuff, right?
Yeah.
And just a little bit of wobble like in them and stuff, you know? And then you can take those and you can just kind of, you know, dunk and kind of paste them together and move them around.
Yeah.
Right. To make a modular dungeon. Right. And you can kind of, you know, do whatever you want with it, rotate around and all that stuff. Right. And so I made this dungeon here. Just for kicks and giggles. Let me render it so you can see it, right? Look at that.
Oh, that's cool.
Doesn't that look awesome?
Yeah. All the lighting and everything in there.
Yeah, just a low poly dungeon with everything in there. So let me you can actually go to view, navigate. Where is it? Navigate and then walk. And then I can turn on gravity and I can walk around inside my little dungeon. Wow. Make him walk around inside my little dungeon, right?
Yeah.
So really cool. So that's fun. And all of these assets all these assets you can export and bring them into Unity or the Unreal Engine so that you can make a game with these assets. This is what a lot of people use to make these things, right? So really fun Blender free tool. If you ever have any desire to learn how to do 3D modeling or just to understand like what all goes into these kind of models that are inside the games we play, just get on YouTube and watch Blender Guru. So Blender space GURU. He's a great, very friendly guy. As far as I can tell, but and it's all free. There's nothing you have to pay besides your internet fees to have, you know, be able to watch stuff online.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. And obviously, you know, you could 3D print that stuff. But I think there's some things in between because you do a lot of tricks with Blender where like how smooth those donuts looked. Like they're not really that smooth. Like they're actually polygony, but you put like smooth shading filters on them for the actual render. So going from like the actual model to the render, there's a bunch of stuff in between that I think makes the model not ready to actually print.
Right.
To look
right.
like that when you would print it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was my geek week.
Well, I wonder if you put it in a slicer, if that just kind of takes it from point A to point B.
There's probably, I'm sure there's stuff, I'm sure there's absolutely ways to do it. I mean, people make minis in Blender and stuff like that. It's just, I just don't know it yet. So,
yeah.
My daughter's like, can you 3D print that donut for me? I'm like, yeah, we could just go buy a donut and you know, you could have a donut. So,
it doesn't look like a Homer Simpson donut, though.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Sweet.
What about you?
Awesome. So, I had, I was out in Las Vegas last weekend, and I had a great time with my brothers one night. We decided to go out, and my brother who lives in Las Vegas says, I know where we're going tonight. We're going to the Pinball Hall of Fame Museum.
Nice.
So I'm pulling up our Discord here. So hey, listen, if you're not in our Discord, follow the link below. Jump in it with us. We talk about all sorts of stuff. We talk about Warcry, obviously. We talk about RPGs. We talk about, you know, board games, all sorts of stuff. And sometimes we get to talk about cool things that we do, like going to the Las Vegas Pinball Hall of Fame, right? So this is right off of the strip, pretty much. I mean, well, maybe not right off the strip, but it's like downtown Las Vegas, pretty much. And, you know, there's the Hall of Fame sign. There's like, you know, just a giant pinball. It's like a giant warehouse, right? Yeah. That's there. And I
I've
mean,
heard about this place too.
You can see in this picture that it's just like rows and rows and rows of pinball and arcade games. And what's cool about some of them, let me see if I can pull up an old one that I played.
The Terminator 2.
Dr. No one. So no, oh, yeah. That doesn't show it. Like, so some of them I noticed they had oh, like this. Okay, so I played this Royal Rumble pinball game, right? And what's cool is you can see down here at the bottom these little, like, tan cards right here. And it gives a history of the pinball machine. Like, when it was created, who made it, like, you know, where this one was acquired from. And, you know, like, so, like, not every machine, but a lot of the older ones especially that are kind of part of the Hall of Fame Museum. That were, I think some of these were donated as well and kind of refurbished, so you could play on them. So it's really, I mean, it's a ton of fun. And here's the best part. There's no entry fee to go in there. All you do is you just, you know, take your $10 bill or $20 bill or whatever you want to do.
Oh.
And you just feed the machine with quarters and you go play. I mean, like, you don't have to pay a cover charge essentially to go in there. So we had a great time. Let's see. Let me show you some of the games I played. I played The Mandalorian, Star Wars one. This was a newer one. And what's crazy about this is, like, you would play this game, and there's, like, a whole movie happening on the screen right there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be honest with you. I sucked at this game because the movie was going on, and I'm trying to do the flippers. It's
distracting you.
And I'm just, like, so distracted. And I'm like, it's telling me to do a mission, and I don't know what the mission is. And all of a sudden, next thing I know, like, the ball's just going in the wrong spots. And so I was like, ugh, I did terrible on, like, the newer games, but it was fun to play, right?
Yeah.
Like, I had a good time.
That looks like it's a Stern pinball machine. Sternpinball.com. They're, like, probably the premier modern pinball maker today.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But they've got amazing pinball machines. In fact, if you pull up that Mandalorian one again.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ones on either side, I think, are also Stern pinballs. Because look at the speaker, the way the speaker and the display are set up. That's that looks a lot like. But their pinball machines are like $8,000 to $12,000.
Yeah, I would not be surprised.
Yeah,
the ball on this was like super smooth. I mean, like
couldn't even hear it rolling.
No, and like sometimes, like on some of the older ones, I'll show you some of the older ones. Like you could feel it rolling. Like, you know what I mean? And it's going through here and it's like flying through there. And I'm like having a hard time keeping up with like how fast it's going and all that stuff. It's just super smooth, right? Contrast that with the Terminator 2 pinball machine. This one's seen some love, right? you know, I mean, like, this was a little old school. I tended to do a lot better on the old school ones. Maybe because the balls weren't moving as fast and, you know, there wasn't like as many flashy lights going on.
Right.
But had a good time doing it. My favorite one that I played, and by the way, they had a whole bunch of different like arcade games. Like I played Punch Out a few times. you know, like I love Punch Out, right? Yeah. So like that was a great time.
Yeah. And, I love Punch Out, man.
I know, it's so good. And my favorite one that I played was this Dr. No one, believe it or not.
Yep.
It was like I just had so much fun. Like you're like trying to capture villains, you're trying to like, you know, unlock Q that gave you like rockets and stuff like that, and like those gave you bonus balls. And there was one point I had four balls bouncing around in there.
Oh, I love multi ball. Yeah.
I'm just like, what am I doing? I'm just hitting the flippers like crazy, you know.
Yeah.
So it was pretty wild. But this Dr. No One was maybe my favorite. I had a great time.
So that just so you know, that has four editions. The version you played was the Pro Edition.
Oh, interesting.
There's a premium, a limited, and then the 60th anniversary limited edition.
Wow.
The version that you played, I'm looking on Stern Pinball, so it is MSRP $7,000.
Wow.
Okay. The limited edition is MSRP $13,000. And the 60th anniversary limited edition doesn't have a price on the page, so
it's like call for price,
right?
Right. It's the chef special.
Yeah.
You know,
but yeah, so. No. If you are jonesing for a pinball machine in your house and you've got the money, Stern Pinball is the way to go nowadays.
Yeah.
But if you're not, you can get a used pinball machine like on Craigslist, you know, or whatever, for probably on the order of around like $2,000 to $2,500. Uh-huh. 2000 to 2500. But this is why I have a digital pinball machine in my basement.
Right. Yeah.
and that was a good, that was a good $600. But yeah. $600 is cheaper than
8,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not so, as fun.
Yeah. If you guys were in Vegas, you need to go here. Like, you need to check this out. I dropped $10. Like, we all just kind of went in with $10 because we had other plans that evening to go do things, you know. But we dropped $10 in there, and I think I spent probably 2 hours playing. You know what I mean? Like, most of the games were 50 cents. There were some that were a dollar. You know, like the newer ones were, like the Mandalorian one was a dollar, but most of them were 50 cents. Some of them were even 25 cents. You know, we played the, like, Super Nintendo version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yep, Turtles in Time.
Kind of like, yeah. So we had a great time with that. And it was four players, and my brothers are all shaped the same way that I am. So we were like packed in there, like trying to like hit the buttons.
Good stuff.
It was good. It was a great time. So yeah, that was like one of my main Geek Week things. I had a great time there. And again, I recommend if you're ever in Vegas, like, and you're looking for something to do that doesn't cost a lot of money, like craps tables and things like that, go to the Pinball Hall of Fame. It's awesome. It's a lot of fun. And there's like a ton of restaurants like right around there too that are really great as well. So that aren't like strip pricing. You know what I mean? So a lot of fun right there. So yeah, that was kind of my Geek Week. I got some other stuff, but I think we need to move on. So
yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, had a great time with it. Awesome. All right. Well, Dan's not here to give us our customary news intro, but we do have news today.
We do.
We got a bunch of news, actually, the stuff that has come out, and we want to share it with you. We'll start with Free League Press right now. Never one to sit on their laurels. Free League Press has announced a couple of things that are coming out. One, this is coming up. So this is Coriolis, the Great Dark RPG, Explorer Lost Horizon. So I have the Kickstarter page up because they are going to be announcing this on Kickstarter. I mean, they've announced it, but they're going to be dropping it here in a little bit.
Is it March 19th when it kicks?
I think it's even, March 19th. Yes, yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So if you are interested in a sci-fi setting that is put on by Free League Press, get notified on Kickstarter for this. This is really interesting. So I want to read a little bit of their blurb just to kind of like give you a sense of what this is. Free League Publishing is proud to announce Coriolis, the Great Dark, a brand new science fiction role-playing game about exploration, mysteries, and intrigue at the far edge of space. venture out into the unknown on mighty great ships, delve into deep ancient ruins, and partake in the Byzantine schemes of powerful guilds. So it's inspired by 19th century polar expeditions, deep sea diving, and pulp archaeology. So kind of in a sci-fi setting. So when I read that, Jason, I kind of feel like it gives me oh my gosh, I just forgot the name of the game. What's the name with the big daddy?
Bioshock. Yeah, Bioshock.
Bioshock. It gave me like a Bioshock feel, but in space. You know what I mean? Kind of like where you're sort of isolated, but you've got these like kind of, and it's got a very grim, darky feel about it. It's not like a Star Trek happy, everybody's happy, you know, space feel. It's got kind of a, but it's not quite as like war laden as maybe a 40K RPG.
Yeah. You know like what I mean? Rogue Trader was.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So, that, I think that's going to be what's curious about it is how much is, like, how much is it just like the vastness of space and having exploration and adventures with the guilds, or are there large scale threats that are happening, or is it really just pocketed stuff out in the great vastness of space, right? Because at the end of the day, like, space is big, right? It's really big. So, understand, you know, if you get to interstellar travel, then you can kind of shrink the feeling of that, but at the end of the day, space is still extremely big, so
it's a little vast.
Just a little. I remember when I played Elite Dangerous, by the way, love that game. It's, you know, fond memories. It's kind of it's time is kind of gone, but they actually that was a space simulation because they actually modeled the scale of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
Like fully. And there were people who play that game that were just, they were playing as explorers. So they were just, they created, you know, like they had like fuel harvesters that could harvest fuel from suns. And they were just making their way to the core
as
of the
far universe. Out as they could go.
Yeah. Or to the core of the universe. Whatever right. So, but yeah, I mean, and they've been playing the game for like, and this guy's like, my travels over the last 30 days of real time.
Yeah.
It was like 30 days of every night playing Elite Dangerous and just flying out into the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. Right? You're just going straight until you run out of fuel
and
picking up more fuel.
Yeah.
And then going again.
And there's just empty systems with rocks and planetary bodies that could be my camera's going whack, but bodies. It's like that game really gave you the sense of the vastness of space.
Totally.
And the majority of the players that all played Eve played in this tiny little pocket in the galaxy, or not but Elite Dangerous. Eve is another one that's kind of like that.
Yep.
But
tiny, tiny little pocket, depending on the faction you started, and you pretty much stayed there. Right.
Yep.
So, yeah, so I'm curious about Coriolis. Now, what's interesting is that this is a standalone game. It's not an expansion of the current Coriolis that's out there. So, I mean, think of this as like maybe a next edition, even though they're not calling it a second edition or anything like that. But it's a separate game. I mean, I guess it's almost like, you know how like Warhammer 40K RPGs have like Wrath and Glory and Rogue Trader, and like they all exist in the same universe, but they've got they're different games because they're focused on different things.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably a better analogy than like a new edition, like a D&D 4th edition to 5th edition or something like that. So so check it out. Coming out March 19th, if you're interested, pick it up. All right. So the other thing is that Free League does this, right? They have a system that it uses the Year Zero engine. For example, the One Ring uses the Year Zero engine, but then they have the 5th edition version of that, which they call the Lord of the Rings role-playing game, right? So it's almost like they're two separate things. So they have, Free League has a system called Simbarum, that uses the Year Zero engine, but then they also have a system called Ruins of Simbarum, and that is a 5th edition version of it. I'm not exactly sure if it takes place after like what happens in the Simbarum vision, like if they're kind of different times or settings, but they just announced some expansions for fifth edition rules. So they've got the World of Simbarum, which is a kind of a settings book, and then they have the Throne of Thorns one, which has some campaigns in it. So, you know, I'm going to be honest. I heard some people talking about Simbarum, and it sounds like a really compelling setting. It's kind of like a Game of Thrones esque fantasy setting, from what I can tell, where it's low magic but kind of high grit, you know, in it. So I'd be curious to see like the setting. I got to dig into this a little bit more. But for those that play Simbarum or that are interested in about it, they're getting more expansions here that you can use in your games, and they look pretty cool. So check it out. Let's see. Yeah, that's what I got for Free League. What else do we have up on the thing? Okay, Call of Cthulhu. Okay, so one thing that just came out, like literally just came out, was is this new book called Call of Cthulhu Arkham. And this is one of their babies. I haven't seen them do a full court media press for something like this in a long time, right? Chaosium. Maybe the mansions. Yeah. Chaosium. Yeah. Like maybe, the Mansions of Madness that they had, that was like a really big sort, kind of adventure book. Mm-hmm. But this one's big because this is all about the lore of Arkham. And, I mean, for those who know H.P. Lovecraft, I mean, Arkham is like the central place of pretty much all H.P. Lovecraft stories. I mean, you have it elsewhere, but like, this is like ground zero for all of his horror stories, mm-hmm. right? And so what's cool is this is a sandbox setting, so it gives you like 290 locations across like 9 neighborhoods that you can kind of build your story in Arkham. You know, and they're like pretty detailed. You can, you've got like gossip and rumors to use the scenario seeds in there. You've got like a whole bunch of 80 NPCs. So you're not being like, what's his name? His name is Jeff.
Yeah. Saul.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you've got a lot of stuff to build from this, right? You've got like some, like game aids that it comes with, like a poster sized map of Arkham that you can kind of lay out and people can go through. They've got like little like newspaper clippings and things that you can use, which is kind of cool. And then it's like the definitive guide to Arkham. So like it's just chock full of lore, right? Like it's not just it's like setting and lore, and gets into like the Miskatonic University.
Be great
it gets
to read. Into
all this stuff.
Good bedtime reading, like, right before you fall asleep.
I made that mistake a few times. The gods of the deep are calling to me in my
dream. Yeah.
You know, so yeah. But anyway, it's awesome. There's the hardcover book goes for $59.99. You can get the PDF, but for a book like this, I would argue you should probably go hardcover. This is something that you keep on your shelf and you reference a lot, and the art in it is going to be amazing and great. So, check that out. The last thing that I wanted to bring up with Chaosium is that the Graveyards of Arkham actual play podcast is out on YouTube. You should all go listen to it immediately. The Bookshops of Arkham was such an amazing series, and they have just really picked up and run. It's still got the same tone and feeling. In fact, two of the actors that were in it are back again for this one, and they got two new actors. And they have, of course, Mark Meer is the keeper. And if you close your eyes and you drift away as you're listening to Mark Meer speak, you will feel like you're on the Normandy ship in Mass Effect, because he is the voice of Commander Shepard. So it is a little bit of a mind trip.
Wait, you know, Commander Shepard was a female for me.
Oh dear. What did you do? What did you do, Jason? She must have had a husky voice then. No, so he voiced the male Commander Shepard, of course, you know, and he's so good at this keeper job. Like he's so good at it. And what I love is they play with the Roll20 system. Like, they use Roll20 as they're doing the actual play, and all of them have tablets, right? And so what happens is he'll say, like, okay, roll a psychology check for me. And they hit their button, and it rolls the dice, and it will show you on the screen the roll that they got. Do you know what I mean? So you can see if they passed or failed and stuff like that. And it's really, I think it's super well done. It really sucks you in. They have these guest people that come on as NPCs and are acting things out. And I'm going to be the first to admit, I'm not like the biggest fan of Critical Role. I sometimes have a hard time getting into it, but I've not had that problem with Great Bookyard or Bookshops of Arkham. And then now the Graveyards of Arkham. Like, they're just
cool.
They're so good. And the writers, you can tell they have a deep love of H.P. Lovecraft. Like, these are like the most Lovecraftian stories like I've ever heard, you know? So they're just really, really great. So check them out. All good things. And we might end up having some people on to talk about Graveyards of Arkham when it wraps up and, you know, kind of go from there. So that's what I have from Chaosium.
Yeah. Oh, there's one more on Chaosium, right? They announced a board game. They're making the board game version of Call of Cthulhu Horror on the Orient Express.
So
this was originally like a 1990s RPG setting or arc for Call of Cthulhu.
So it's funny you mentioned that because what
it's funny.
Do I have here? But I have shoot. Oh, okay. All
right. We can see it.
Hold it in front of my chest.
Yeah.
All right. So
that's their reprint.
This is what it is, dude.
Oh, they gave you the original with it as well, huh?
No, Jason. It's a 2-volume RPG.
Oh.
The whole RPG are these two books. So are you familiar with the Orient Express?
Oh yeah.
Right? Like it goes from like it goes from like London to Constantinople back in the day, right? And so which is now Istanbul, not Constantinople. But so volume one is London to the Alps. And then volume two is Italy to Constantinople. And what happens on this is that you basically stop at each of the stops and run an adventure. So you run one in London before you get on the train, and then some crazy things will happen. And then you get to Paris and you stop for like a day and you got like an adventure that happens there. It's just a lot of like, it looks really cool. I want to run it, but it's a pretty involved.
Yeah. It seems like it's going to be a long, so let me share my screen. So they're actually making a board game.
I know.
Chaosium is making a board game, Horror on the Orient Express. They're not planning to release it until 2025, but at Gen Con this year, they're going to have a prototype. So seek Chaosium at their booth 509 to see a prototype of the board game Horror on the Orient Express.
So
Adam, guy over here, I'm not even going to try to say his last name. One of the designers for Nemesis and Frostpunk. So they've got they got some guys that know how to make some board games on here.
And then they have Mishout Gotebiowski. We're sorry we don't speak Polish.
We're not even saying that.
Last year, I don't think you had left Gen Con early because you needed to catch a flight.
Yeah.
But on Sunday, we had an exclusive sneak peek of this game at Gen Con.
Oh.
And we talked with Michael, who actually, I think Michael might
Michael or Mika?
Mikat?
Yes.
We talked with him about kind of the game. And they had basically, I mean, you want to talk about prototype. It was like the prototype of prototypes. Like it had some like pretty basic printed cards. It had some cardboard train stuff. Like it seemed pretty cool from what I saw. So I know that they were hoping to get this to Kickstarter. I think they were talking about doing it in 2024, but it sounds like 2025 is not going to be the release date.
Well,
but you,
they'll be releasing. You
should check it out.
Yeah. Nick, it sounds like a release date is planned as 2025, so we don't know. But Gen Con, there will be a official demo prototype this year. So,
instead of the kind of like
design. Hey, we've got some cardboard cutouts. And
this Lego man represents you.
Right. Right. Have you ever seen – that's a funny side before we get our main topic. Have you ever seen those people that play 40K with Legos?
No.
Yeah, they get a, they have just a tabletop full of Legos, right? Where they've made these little like Lego people and like given them like architected them up like in mech suits and
yeah,
it's just, it's hilarious, dude.
That's amazing.
But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, when you have the rule book.
Yep. I mean, you can play with paper cups if you really needed to, right?
Yeah.
So.
All right, cool.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, cool. A lot of good stuff coming up. I think we're feeling sort of a ramp up to like the convention season. Origins is only like 3 months out, right? Gen Con is like 5 months out. Like, you're starting to see like a whole bunch of releases that are going to get attention at Gen Con. And so like, now's the time, right, to start looking for some of these cool things coming out and what's going to be hot for 2024.
Yep.
So awesome. Very good. Okay, well, let's get to our main topic. So we talked about, you know, at the very beginning of the show that we feel like D&D a little bit has lost its love and feeling. We feel like you know, it's not as enjoyable to play as much as like maybe we remembered way back when. Yeah. Right. And
yeah.
And so we're just, I don't know, Jason, if it's because we have been trying out so many other systems that feel innovative and interesting. And we just kind of go back and we're like, oh, okay, this is like, you know, like D&D might be the vanilla while we're trying Fudge Ripple somewhere else. You know what I mean? And so I don't know if that's the problem, but we just wanted to kind of explore like maybe what some of our thoughts were about D&D and like how we could like inject or infuse some excitement back into it and kind of make D&D great again.
Yeah. Well, I think we have to caveat our discussion that's about to start with the fact that, look, D&D is very successful, like in terms of a product and a portfolio. It is a very successful role-playing product that, you know, WotC with their, you know, newfound love and support have been able to bring to a market and bring to a larger market and really open the kind of addressable, total addressable market for that and take advantage of it. So we're not making any claims on the success of D&D or its ability to actually give people that role-playing experience. What we're trying to show is, hey, we've been role-playing for a long time. We've role-played lots of systems. And having gone to lots of systems and then come back to D&D, here are some of the things we feel D&D has kind of moved away from for like, and what could maybe some recommendations to kind of get back into it. So I think that's some things to keep in mind as we kind of push.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of this stuff is like, you know, me speaking from having GM'd a recent D&D campaign and, you know, have played in some of them and, you know, like this is kind of speaking from personal experience here, you know, like having run it. So to understand like how we might be able to infuse D&D with more fun, what are some of the issues do you think, Jason, that we're running across here?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out if I want to hit some of my big ones first and maybe start with some of the lighter ones first. So, all right. So I'm going to start with a lighter one first.
Okay.
And that's kind of that I'm kind of using a pun there. I kind of feel like a lot of the setting and stuff is feeling a little too fluffy to me.
Okay.
This, I don't know if the setting part of, you know, WotC taking it to get to kind of a broader audience has been to adjust the setting and adjust the material to be appealing to that larger audience. When I played D&D a long time ago, I played it. It was very much more of a Lord of the Rings style feel.
Okay.
Where, you know, there was a lot of good that was happening, but there was a lot of bad. The bad was really bad when it was happening. Magic was not huge. Like if you think of Eberron, right? The setting Eberron before Forgotten Realms, like Eberron was a low magic setting initially. And so it was really kind of a lot of brute force sword and board You had to really, it was really taxing on the world and on the players. And yeah. Now when I've played several kind of D&D systems, I think the GM absolutely has the flavor and the control to make it as lethal as they want, as, as grim dark as they want. But I think a lot of the stuff, I feel like it kind of has like a happy go lucky feel.
Yeah.
Like here we go. We're going to go up there and we're going to pound our sword and then we're going to cast spells and throw fireballs and the goblins are all going to die. And then we're going to get our treasure and then we're going to go to the next town and level up. And, right. it doesn't seem like as threatening to me anymore it used to.
Interesting. I think, I'd like to kind of add to that a little bit, I think that one of the issues that comes with that are players' expectations because of the familiarity of the setting, you know, like, so if I'm a new player, I mean, think of this, like if I were a wizard, a brand new wizard, I just got my new hat and everything, and I've got my spell book and I'm walking along and I have like 8 health points because I'm a brand new wizard. And I'm walking along and I see a band of menacing goblins. I'm probably going to start to freak out a little bit because I'm not that hardy. But the players don't feel that way. The players are like, okay, here we go.
Yeah.
Like, just kill them and then we level up. Ding, 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 ding. It's almost like a Vegas slot machine a little bit. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And so there's like metagaming that happens without meaning to metagame. Like, I'm not suggesting that players are like opening the monster manual and pulling up like, you know, goblin hit points and resistances and things like that.
That's
part of it too, right? Like, well, how many times have you played goblins and you know that like they are, you know, have resistances or they are certain weaknesses and things like that, and you're just like, oh, I'm gonna cast fire because I know that this monster's weakness is fire.
Yeah. Or there's I rolled a hit, I got a 13. 13's a miss. Okay, 13 is a miss.
Right.
Next time I rolled a hit, I got a 16. 16's a hit. Okay, so somewhere between 14 and 16. You know.
Yeah. But, totally. Yeah. You know, so there's some like metagaming that happens that I feel like kind of ruins the flavor immersion. A little bit, the immersion, you know, like contrast this, and I don't want to do a full, like, you know, contrast and compare, but like contrast this with the Year Zero engine where you need to roll A6 to succeed.
Yeah.
I don't have a target number. I don't have, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not rolling for a 13 or a 9. Yeah. I'm not like, you know, like roll isn't based on whether or not they're resistant or immune to certain damage. I just roll. And if I get something, I succeed. Right. Like,
and a lot of this is the party that are the people that you're playing with too. Right. Cause we play with good role players where it'll be like, you know, I know that goblins are resistant or, you know, that fire will do more to them, but my character doesn't know that. So he's not even going to think to pull the scroll out of his
right
belt,
right,
you know? Yeah, so there's good players too, like I said, good players and good GMs can kind of counter some of these problems, but these are just things that I think we've seen kind of across the board with D&D.
I'll tell you though, there is a problem of having very experienced GMs though, and this shows up in the encounters and the combat phase. It's really, really, really hard. And this is speaking from experience. It's really hard to develop a balanced encounter with very experienced players. And I'm not saying experienced characters. I'm saying experienced players, because experienced players will know how to move their character, do their thing, exploit the bonus action. You know, I mean, like, we're playing in things where it's like my wizard loves going up behind a dude and yanking him with a lightning lure away from you, Jason. So that it triggers your attack of opportunity, so you get an extra hit, right? And it's like, that's an experienced player move, not an experienced character move. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's exploitations there. So what that does is it makes it really hard to find a good balance in an encounter, because you go too light, they're going to walk all over them, and it's going to feel super boring. All of a sudden, you just are like, okay, well, I'm going to throw in a frost giant now. And he TPKs the entire party.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's just like the balance is so hard. And I don't know what the solution to that is. Maybe we can talk about that in a little bit. But like, that kind of goes with the metagaming, because like you are metagaming the rules a little bit too. You know, like, okay, well, my guy has his reaction still. And if I do this, then that, then this, then that. You know what I mean? And so I think it makes it hard for the GM to control the balance feel.
Well, you're optimizing, you know, my knight or whatever he's called in the setting we're doing can forego his action to command another player to take a free attack. Mm-hmm. So if I know that these guys take a 15 plus to hit, I'm not even going to try to swing my sword, even though I'm standing in front of him. I'm going to command someone who I know has a high attack bonus to go for it. Well, the knight wouldn't really do that. He would probably try to swing a sword and bash with a shield or whatever. I don't know. That's it, like you said, good players and GMs can do it, but then you get the problem of it becomes a lot harder for the GM when you have good experienced players.
Right, right.
That play, because they know all of the options that are available, all the combinations that come available to them, which might get to another problem you have is that there is so much in terms of classes, expansions, things that, like, how does an experienced GM that is not like a full-time, this is my life, how do they create that challenge encounter, keeping in mind any possible combination of stuff that could really be thrown at them with all the rule specialization rule books and extra feats and talents and all those things that pop in there.
Listen, I 100% agree with that. I mean, like, as a GM, if I were starting out with a group of people, in fact, I when I ran Rime of the Frost Maiden, I said, no Unearthed Arcana.
Oh, totally.
I just can't keep up with that. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's impossible. Yeah. But if I have, and basically I got the D&D Beyond subscription, and I think when it first came out, I got a Founders Pack that has like a ton of source books in it. And I said, look, if it's in my source books, you can use it, right? Because you can create the D&D from the DM's library. You can create a character, you know? And so I said, if it's in my source book, you can use it. I don't care if it's a turtle or, you know, like whatever. As long as it's in my source book, you can use it. Anything else, please don't, because I just can't keep up with it. Not that it was like a bad thing. It's just like, I can't remember all the rules And the problem is that if you as a player find this really like niche combo that you have really tried to optimize, you're going to want to use it at every opportunity. And if your DM doesn't know how to regulate that a little bit, it ends up becoming not fun for all of the other players.
Yeah.
You know? And so the DM has to kind of regulate it by bringing in different monsters or different, you know, combinations of monsters or traps, or, you know, like, you know, if your special thing is like every time I hit with a sword, it gives me a plus 30 damage or something like that, you know? Well, okay. Like, now you're fighting ghosts for an encounter or something like that, where it's like, it's not doing what it's supposed to do. Figure out another way. You know what I mean? And that's how you kind of keep your players on their toes a little bit. You know, if the DM's not abreast of all of this, which it's really hard to be, it can cause some problems, I think.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it can. And it can be difficult to try to not feel like you're railroading to counter a player's secret pinning combination.
Right.
You can see that a lot. Like, well, they're resistant to that damage. Why would they be resistant? Yeah. Because they are. Because you do too much damage. That's why. You know. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, four more goblins come in through the side trees. Why? Because I'm not ready for this counter to end yet. Because you guys are too powerful.
Exactly. You know? You guys are too powerful. Yeah. You killed them way too fast, right? Yeah. So let me ask you, do you think so Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast, they make their money off of products. They make their money off of source books. They make their money off of D&D Beyond. They make their money off of new adventure books. They come out with at least one new adventure book a year. Usually that adventure ends up in the Adventures Guild that people can play like around the world, you know, week by week type of thing.
Yeah.
and which is cool. I mean, it's a great concept and stuff like that. Do you feel like the books are a bit of a problem of making D&D maybe not as fun as it could be?
I've thought about this one a lot. I've also recognized the fact that I do have that old school feel because of how I grew up and what age I grew up in, right? And in the, I grew up in the, we didn't have computers to, we have computers that only nerds can use to, we have computers, then we have smartphones, and many people just don't even have computers anymore. They just have phones, you know? So
yeah.
I've seen the full transition. So I still, in fact, I have my, when we play, even though we play through D&D Beyond, I have my player's handbook, my hardback handbook here, because I like to have it open because I just love the feeling of looking through there. I think D&D Beyond has made it, is actually solving this problem a little bit of all the books, because there are, it kind of compiles everything together into one accessible place, right?
That's true.
It doesn't make it as inaccessible. A DM can look up really quickly. Anyone can look up really quickly. But I think the point that you're getting at is, maybe the point that you're getting at is, there is so many trees and so many branches and so much material out there around one game system that the mechanics and the specialized mechanics attached to specific classes is just growing and growing and growing to, is it becoming, becoming unwieldy in its own?
Well, there's that 100%. I'm asking about that a little bit. Like, are the source books becoming a little unwieldy, right? Like, you've got, you know, kind of the Candlekeep Mysteries that came up with new classes and new abilities and new spells and stuff like that, right? There's that. Are the adventure books part of the problem, right? Are they too railroady? Do they not balance the encounters well enough? Or do they have too many encounters, like, that are back to back? Like,
are they less roleplay focused?
Are they less roleplay focused and more combat focused? You know, like, I mean, do you think the adventure books are a bit of the problem? And, you know, like, what do you think?
I think that I feel that all role-playing games, what separates them from just playing a digital role-playing game is that there should be freedom in story to tweak and test the story, so that you're not giving a story, then you're waiting for the players to figure out the path, figure out the story path to get to the last to get to the last chapter in the book. But you're telling a story and evolving the story with the players. To me, that's what makes a good role-playing experience. When you play out of a book, some books are written as setting books.
Right.
In that case, I don't consider that what we're talking about here.
Sure.
What we're talking about is when you buy a book that has an arc, like Rime of the Frost Maiden, or Out of the Abyss, or
Or Dragonlance that we're playing.
Dragonlance.
The Rise of Tiamat, right?
Yeah. Like, or Horde of the Dragon Queen, or all of those things. There's kind of, you have to get from one part of the story to the other part. The story's written for you. I think it's great for early gamers that don't really know a lot, that GMs aren't as experienced, and they can grab it and run with it. But I think that they're providing a little bit too much of a railroad in the story, and not flexibility to have the story evolve on its own and become a thing of itself, which is what is the beauty behind RPGs for me. Like, every time I GM an RPG, I have a general idea of what's going on in the world.
Right.
And if players could follow that, what's going on in the world. But half the time, more than half the time when I GM, almost every time, based on what the players do, the world changes and my story changes. It's always changing when I GM with players. I've always changing it to make it more epic and more pertinent to the characters themselves versus the story for the sake of the world. It's the story for the sake of the experience of the players.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you lose the ability to do that with these books.
Well, I feel like some books are, not all books are created equal. Let me put it that way. Right. Some books are very good about providing a very sandboxy feel, like, hey, adventurers, go choose what you want. We've got lots of opportunities for you to do certain things. And some books don't do that as much. Some books say, hey, this is your mission. This is what you're being called to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
It's just about being able to defeat the encounters that are in front of you.
Exactly. And so, obviously my preference is to play in the ones where you get a little bit more choice and freedom of movement. I do have to say this, and this is an important distinction. Like, an adventure book needs an ending. Do you know what I mean? Like, it needs an ending. Like, that book can't be an infinite book forever and ever and ever. It's got to have a finite amount of pages. So that book has to have an ending. Maybe you can continue that adventure, like, as a homebrew with your friends if you wanted to. But there needs to be a finality to the arc that is in the book. I believe that Rime of the Frost Maiden may be one of the best ones that struck that tone, where in the beginning of the book, it gave you so many options. In fact, we could go back and play that game, Rime of the Frost Maiden, and start in a different town and have a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. Completely different experience, because we didn't even touch 2/3 of the towns.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, we just did a couple of things here or there.
Yep.
But then, you know, as you got to a certain point, the way that the book did this is the Frost Maiden saw that you started meddling in her affairs. She started sending some agents after you every now and then, and they would cause some problems for you, and you'd have to deal with them, as you should, right? You're just kind of trying to live your life, but now they're kind of coming to antagonize you, and now you're on her radar, and now you're going to have to take care of it. Right.
Yep.
And so that was kind of the arc of the Rime of the Frost Maiden. We had so much fun with this campaign. We had so much fun with this campaign. And I think because it did exactly what you talked about, it gave you guys the freedom to do what you want. At one point, you guys took over, and it said this in the book, actually. It said, hey, there's a derelict inn that is here, and the mayor can offer it as payment for doing something for them if they want it. And that's where you got the White Moose in. And that was like your driver for like half the game, was to like go
get that thing profitable.
Things. Yeah. Make it profitable. Right. Like, go do some things to like make it profitable and get it going. And like, it was hilarious, 'cause like you guys ended up finding an elf mummy that was forever like indebted to you. So you ended up putting him in your basement, watching
he guarded our wares.
Exactly. You know? And I mean, like, you had Johan, who was like an NPC, and you're like paying him to manage the inn and all this stuff. And we had a great time like adding that in there. And again, like, that was something that kind of was a hook in the book that they left in there. And I thought that was very well done, because it gave you guys something to do as you went along. There was another instance where one of the player's secrets, Lincoln, his secret was that he had a long lost love somewhere in 10 towns, right? And that he could tell me who it was at any time. And we went up into this dwarven castle because they were causing some problems. You heard that they were like threatening the town. And they had tried to kill you guys a couple of times. So you're like, okay, this aggression will not stand, man. Right? So you guys decided to go up there. And sure enough, like, one of the boss ladies in there, you guys burst into her chamber where she was eating. And Lincoln's like, that's her. She's my long lost love. You know what I mean? And also I'm like, okay, let's do this.
All right, let's do it. And let's do it.
Yeah. And, you know, the book kind of allowed us to do that. Like, it wasn't so rigid that I couldn't be like, oh, I'm sorry, she's your mortal enemy forever and ever and ever. You know, the book let us be like, okay, well, let's do this, and we'll just kind of play it off, because there's other dwarves that still hate them, even though they have this, you know, romantic tryst. So I think some books do it better than others.
So it kind of sounds like books as themselves may not be the problem, but maybe there's just a lot of books out there that don't follow kind of the pattern of Rime of the Frost Maiden.
Yeah, I think if you were a DM and you're like, you know what, I think I want to run the Tombs of Annihilation, or I want to, you know, run the Storm Giants one that they had out there. I think you need to read through the book fully and be like, is this the kind of campaign that I want to run? You know what I mean? Is this like, does it feel too railroady? And maybe it's like 80% totally good and 20% too railroady for you. And maybe you can like work to kind of fix those areas a little bit, you know, just kind of adjust them if you need to.
You got to just decide what you want out of an RPG. Do you just want a dungeon crawler or do you want like a story experience?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a positive thing for it is that it,
yeah,
it has the flexibility just to be a straight raw dungeon crawler if that's all you want.
I mean, D&D started out that way, didn't it?
To a degree, yeah.
Wasn't it just, I mean, like a lot of the TSR stuff was all like.
Yeah, well, Tombs of Annihilation crawlers, right? Is an example because that's just a reprint of a lot of old dungeon crawling scenarios.
Yeah. So, same with the Yawning Portal, right? Like that was another one.
So I don't, maybe books really aren't the problem. Maybe it's just that the exposure that the mainstream provides, maybe it's not focused enough. Maybe it's not focused enough on kind of that open world evolution with loosely connected things to a larger story arc. Maybe that's one of our recommendations is that's a good way to actually play D&D if you're going to do a story arc.
But let me ask you this. Have you played some very linear railroady RPGs and had a great time doing it?
Sure.
Yeah, why? How did you have a great time doing it?
Well, an example is a lot of intro Chaosium intro Call of Cthulhu's on the pirate ship.
Yes. Oh, that was super railroady. And super I even told railroady. You guys that before we started, right?
Yep.
I said I'm gonna railroad the crap out of you guys tonight, but we're gonna have a great time doing it.
But you also you let us know because I'll tell you this. When you say you're going to get railroady. We didn't know what the railroad was until probably the second player died. Then we're like, okay, we understand the railroad now.
Yeah.
And we still fought it. We still fought that rail.
You did. Yeah.
No, even though we knew that it was impossible to win.
But I mean, we had some epic moments fighting that railroad.
We did, but we were also, we were a group of players that was interested in telling the story, not quote winning the game.
Yes. So I think this is where I'm kind of going with the point here is do you think that sometimes playing D&D we're not telling enough of the story?
Yeah, absolutely. It's more about the focused combat and using your awesome character that you built up and all of your skills and talents and feats. It's more about seeing that in action than it is necessarily about the world around you.
Yeah. I think this is the heart. I think this is the heart of it, because D&D at its core is a character-based game. Okay, so think about the Walking Dead RPG that we played.
That's a good point.
The Walking Dead RPG that we played was not a character-based game. In fact, you could swap out characters at will and still run the story. At its heart, the Walking Dead RPG, is about building your safe haven, right? Like that's what it's really about.
Yep.
And so it's not character focused. D&D is a character focused game. It's about leveling up. What do I get when I level up? Oh, okay. At this point, what do I get? Like, I get talents. I get feats. I get a new spell. It's about leveling up, and that's driving the decision making, in my opinion, a lot of times is about your character. And I also think that that's part of the reason why people get so upset if their character actually dies in D&D.
Yeah.
Because it's about the character in D&D and it's not necessarily as much about the story.
Well, that's how it is with larger scale like MMORPGs. Like think back to Warcraft.
World of Warcraft?
Yeah. World of Warcraft.
Yeah. Yeah,
some of us geeked out over the story and loved the history between the rise of the Alliance and the downfall of the Horde with Thrall and all that stuff. Other people just played that game to get the loot and to get the ding when the level up happened, right? And that's I would probably say the majority of people played it to get the ding and the loot.
Yeah.
And so maybe is that happening with D&D?
I think it is. I think the ding is a big part of the D&D culture, right? Leveling that up. And I think that's also why, I mean, I'm going to ignore the fact that I feel like D&D breaks down after about level 12, in terms of, like, you know, balance in the game and that kind of stuff. High level campaigns are notoriously hard because you have, like, ridiculous stuff. But I also think that that's why people finish an adventure book and be like, okay, when can I start my new character? I've already got ideas for it. Mm-hmm. I've already got ideas for my new guy. You know, I want to play a rogue that does this. I want to play a halfling that does that. I want to play, you know what I mean? Like,
Once again, we're not saying this is bad. Like, people have fun with this. It's great because that's what they want. We're just acknowledging the fact that if that's what you want out of an RPG, then it can float your boat. If you want more narrative or story, I'm struggling to get that with D&D.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So what are some ways that we can do this? So one, less character focused, in my opinion. Okay. And one of the things that we did very clearly in Rime of the Frost Maiden is we moved it to milestone based leveling up. And we've talked about this on previous podcasts, the advantages of different leveling up, you know, methods. But milestone based is great because what that does is, instead of incentivizing going out and killing a bunch of goblins, the incentivization is resolve the situation.
Story progression.
Yeah, story progression and resolve the situation, right? Mm-hmm. And resolving it may be killing somebody, right?
Yeah.
Resolving it may also be talking someone off the ledge.
Right.
You know?
Right. No, that's what it's solving the problem in some way. I think all D&D should be milestone based at this point.
Yep.
I think the only reason you would not play milestone based is if you were just playing a dungeon crawler.
Right.
And I wouldn't play it. If I wanted to play a dungeon crawler, I would just get online and play Diablo or
right.
You know, or something exactly like that. But
So
I think that's one way that can really help is focus on milestone based leveling up, because then your players don't focus on doing things just for the experience. It doesn't enable them to do that. There's no reason. They still can do those things, but it won't be for the reason of getting experience.
Yep. Yep.
So that's one. So another thing that we can talk about that I have an issue with that we could maybe talk about how to recommend to deal with it is, one, because of all of the additional rules and talents and feats and class specific things, I don't even know what to call them half the time, but the like class specific mechanics, it makes it hard. It makes the mechanics of the system very rigid, and it makes it hard for creative narrative combat becomes very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, if someone says, well, I want to, you know, and I've come with a couple examples. I don't know if I can come with one on the fly, but because it's probably going to be wrong, but we'll use an example, right? If somebody says, well, I want to be able to, you know, flip over this guy or jump over this guy of the table and grab him on my way down to try to pull him down to the ground. It's like, okay, well, you're trying to do something that actually resembles a feat on this other class.
Right.
So is it fair? It's not fair that I allow you to try that when he actually had to spend the experience or the level up to take that feat rather than taking the attribute increase. So you can't really do that because the system doesn't let it, because it's specifically a feat and you don't have that feat.
So then the
player is left to not be able to try to do something that would have narratively been exciting. Try to fix my camera here. Narratively been exciting. And of course, once again, a GM and a player base can tweak that, but the system as it's written doesn't provide for it.
Yeah.
And as you add more rules and you try to specify what is done in combat and provide mechanics for everything you could possibly do in combat, you limit the creativity of the player.
Yeah. I'll say I have run other systems with brand new RPG players, right? I'm thinking of the Call of Cthulhu that I ran which is the starter system, and I was running it with the folks, and I basically told them, I said, tell me what you want to do and we'll figure out what dice you need to roll.
Yeah, right.
Do you know what I mean? And they came up with some super creative stuff. Like, I want to drive this van through the graveyard And right before it hits the thing, I want to jump out. Okay, great. Let's see if you even
let's
get
there
first. Give me a driving check, right? Like, let's see if you can drive there first. And then, all right, give me some agility to jump out, right? And so, yeah, like it was easier in those things just to be like, okay, give me this. Tell me what you want to do and we'll figure it out. Whereas I think you're right. Like, there's layers and layers and layers and layers of rules in D&D where it's like, you don't want to disadvantage somebody for taking something that looks awesome by allowing another player just to do it without spending the time and experience in it. You know what I mean? But at the same time, like, that can hurt your narrative a little bit. So you end up with narratives of combat where it's like, all right, so you bring your, you know, your sword down and it chops off his arm and blood gushes out onto the player next to him and it's really gross and he dies in agony. And you're like,
it's really gross.
You're like, oh, I'm like, okay. I mean, like, that's cool. And it's awesome. And it felt like Conan, sure, like, that's awesome. But, like, why not let your player basically describe, like, what kind of heroic feat that they do? And more importantly, why don't you let your player describe how they ended up failing at that because they didn't make the roll?
Yeah, so let me pull on that a minute because you hit an important point. It starts to limit the narrative part of combat to just beautifying the description of what's happening.
Okay.
Versus tweaking it. And I'll give you an example with Chaosium or with great example is Fantasy Flight's narrative dice.
Okay, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to shoot him. You shoot him, you miss. But you get a what's it called? It's called advantage.
An advantage, yep.
Or I hit him, but I have a threat. Yeah. Right. So it gives a gradient on the success scale. Whereas in D&D, there's three things that can happen.
Yeah.
One, you either just miss, like his AC is a 14 and you got a 12. That you miss.
Yeah.
Two, you can hit, his AC is a 14 and you got a 15. Cool.
Yeah.
Three, you can crit. You can either crit hit or crit fail, right? So there's the crit category. But that's a 1 in 20. Maybe a 1 in 19 for some classes.
Yeah.
It's a 1 in 20. It's a very, very, very small window that gives the GM and the players an opportunity to narratively change, have an effect on it. Whereas in a narrative dice system, in free league systems with stress, in the percentile systems that have the three levels of success,
extreme, hard,
you have way more freedom to tweak the narrative of the encounter based off of a single die roll versus, all right, you know, it takes 15 minutes to go around the players. It's my turn to go in. All right, I'm standing right in front of Skama. I'm going to swing my sword. I swing. You miss. Yeah. Okay, what are you going to do? Spit on him. Yeah, okay. You know, and so,
yeah.
All right, then that's it. I mean, I missed. But if I missed with threat or I missed with threat, it's like you miss. And then, you know, gives the GM an opportunity right there in a moment to tweak the scenario. But if I miss but I have advantage, it gives the player an opportunity to tweak the scenario a little bit.
Right.
So I think it's more flavorful, and I feel like and it's maybe not D&D as its own, but a D20 system that doesn't have a narrative dice mechanic in it is difficult.
I agree. And so what you end up having is you try to make the encounter flavorful, right? So you're like, okay, I run into this dwarven hall with a whole bunch of Angi Dwarden, right? And you're like, or Durgar, I guess.
Durgar,
D&D term.
Dwarden, I was trying to figure out what you were. Warhammer.
Sorry. Dwarden is the Warhammer dwarf.
Right.
Durgar, right? Some angry Durgar. And you see 12 Durgar, and you're like, okay, there's four of us, so that's three apiece. And you're like, okay, so you hit the third one for 14 damage. Okay, next up. All right, you hit that one for 3 damage. Okay, now all 12 of them are going to swing back at you.
Right.
You're like, okay. You know what I mean? And like, the DM has to literally roll for like all 12 of them. You know what I mean? As he's going through it. And so, like, that's the flavor that sometimes you end up getting in combat. And so, I don't know. Like, I think, especially like if you're playing out of a book, sometimes I saw this in Rime of the Frost Maiden, I had to adjust some of the encounters just based on the party that we had. Like, and there was one point that called for like a whole bunch of little skeletons. I threw a frost giant in there because it's like you guys were crushing it, you know? And so all of a sudden that made it like a very different encounter and you had to do different things, you know? And I didn't have to bookkeep for freaking 12 skeletons, you know?
Yeah.
Which is a lot, you know?
And once again, I'll say it again, right? A good player and a good GM combo can still add the flavor in. But even if you said, there's a bunch of Jurger in front of me. I'm going to take out, you know, my rope and I'm going to try to do like a long twist event, right? Where I try to like maybe trip the front row so that the back row can't come up and we'll have to climb over them and stuff like that. And the mechanics of the system basically give you kind of a pass fail versus some, you know, more flavor you could put into it. So my recommendation would be to add narrative flavor yourself as a GM, right? So pay attention to the numbers. And this is where, you know, this is a tweak out of the mechanic of the system. If he has to get a 14 to hit and he gets a 13, think about maybe something to do there in the counter that does something there. Or if he's got to get a 14 to hit, or if he's got to get a 12 to hit and he got a 19, you know, it's not a crit, but there's some advantage there. Like that was a powerful hit, right? Take the damage the way you want. I'm not saying add extra damage. I'm not saying that, but do some narrative.
Maybe he falls prone, you know? Maybe
you can't do that because there's a special type of attack to knock people on the ground. And that would, he didn't ask for that kind of attack, but maybe you demoralized him a little bit.
Yeah.
And you know, he's going to, and this is where you just have to throw stuff in. Like I've played with good DMs that'll do that. Like, I do a really hard hit. He says, you can hit we played the other night with our buddy Mike. Mike's like, you hit that guy in his arm. Like it was a lot of damage. Like he's not down, but a lot of damage. So on his next attack, I'm just going to give him a disadvantage because that really like shook him. That's good.
That really hurt.
Yeah.
That really hurt. So I'm also going to say this. If you're a DM listening to this, I highly, 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 highly recommend this book on Amazon. It's called The Monsters Know What They're Doing, Combat Tactics for Dungeon Masters. This basically takes monsters, like different kinds of monsters, and talks about how they would actually fight. Like kobolds are like sneaky, and they do sneaky things. And like to the point where if you're really trying to fight a pack of kobolds, you're in trouble. Like, you're in trouble. They're not just the little, like, stupid creatures that are wandering around that you can just kill, you know? And so he basically, this guy, Keith Amon, he takes, like, these different classes of monsters and uses their stat blocks and say, this is how they should be fighting. This is when they would run away. This is when they would compress the attack. This is when they would do that. Like, this is a great opportunity, I think, for a DM to, like, level up. So that combat encounters don't all feel the same. Yeah. If I'm fighting goblins, it doesn't seem to feel the same as if I'm fighting dwarves, as if I'm fighting, you know, weird mushrooms from the Underdark. Like, if your combats are all feeling the same, it's probably because you're not understanding how to use the monsters as well as they could be used.
Yeah.
And creatively, you know, like, I remember reading a whole thing about this, like, kobold house of horror that, like, they, you know, the adventurers went into this dungeon looking for loot, and the kobolds had like spear holes and like trap doors and like all sorts of stuff that they would like lure these guys into and then disappear behind a trap door, and then poisonous gas would fill the room. Do you know what I mean? Like all sorts of stuff that just was like get us out of here, we do not want to be here with these people anymore. And it made it like a really significant, interesting adventure.
Yeah, that sounds
because
great.
Because it wasn't just like, oh, you turn the corner and there's five of them. Roll initiative. You know? So check this book out. I think it's only like 14 bucks on Kindle. You know? So it I think it'd be worth your time to do that. Just to make combat interesting. Combat, a lot of times in D&D, and I've played it with multiple different people. I've run it myself. Sometimes combat's just like, okay, it's your turn. Swing and a miss. Okay, cool. All right, Jeff, it's your turn. Swing and a hit. Okay, 3 damage. Okay, cool. He's hurting. Yeah, he's hurting. Okay, Steve, it's your turn. You know what I mean? And it's just like, it just feels like this, like,
I wonder if this is like my main issue with D&D right now is the combat just feels very like a sludge. Like I am just sludging through the mire to get through the combat because like I'm not really afraid I'm going to die. If so, I'll get healed. You know, and just let's get through it so we can get to the next narrative part. So I don't know, maybe that's really what some of the biggest issues I have with D&D is the focus on character, which is really about developing things that you can use in combat and less so much developing on social skills that you can use in the role play side of it.
Right. We, you know, it's interesting because literally in the last podcast, we talked about Pendragon and how Pendragon has the opposed combat system. There's no initiative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just like, okay, you're fighting this guy. Both of you roll at the same time and let's see who wins. And I'm going to tell you what, like people were staring at those dice. Do you know what I mean? Like you'd roll it and people were like, what'd you get? Like, you know, because it's like, you know, you're like people were engaged and they weren't at first. They were treating it like D&D at first, where it was like, okay, I rolled a hit. And I'm like, well, I did too. And I hit better. You're not going to take 14 points of damage. I only have like 18. Yeah, I know. They're like, holy crap. Like,
yeah, so
it completely changed the way that they started.
Combine the brutality of the game with, you know, the higher probability of getting actually hit is.
Yeah. And so like that combat all of a sudden changed. It wasn't like, okay, you're up now. What do you do? Swing and miss. Okay, cool. You're up now. Right. Like it was like, oh my gosh, I got two people on me and I'm just trying to like, I'm going into a defensive mode because I'm trying to like hold them off until my buddy can come. You know what I mean? And like, they were like describing what they're doing because like they had to tell me what was happening. They were like literally fighting for their lives. You know, like our friend Tyler King, he had the fear of God on his face for his character. Like he like bled. He's like, I'm going to die. You know? So, you know, that made it really, I think, meaningful. And it didn't feel like we're going through like a bookkeeping exercise.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
So interesting.
Another way to make D&D better is to once again get back to our earlier thing is really make encounters good and better and balanced.
Yeah,
which is hard. It's and maybe that's another thing is it's hard to do
it's
that.
Hard.
Into
D&D. It's hard. It's very hard. Yeah. It's very hard because like I know early on when I would try to make encounters balanced, I said, well, my spellcasters are the problem because they're throwing fireballs and killing five of my dudes at once as they come through the doorway or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So
I'm four people to sleep.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I'm like, okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to send in waves of guys. Okay. This is early on. I'm going to send in waves of guys. I'm going to send in a whole bunch of low level guys. The spellcaster's like, okay, we got this. And they'll just start using up their spell slots. Do. And then all of a sudden, the hard guys are going to come in. Do you know what I mean? And now they're really going to be, like, hurting. And, like, that was not the right choice either.
Yeah, that's the DM metagaming.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's DM
it's metagaming. Like, can you imagine right? the big bad guys standing behind the wall? Okay, that's one spell. Two spell. Right. Okay, he looks like he's a wizard, so he looks like he's a little seasoned, so he's probably got about four spell slots. So let's see, 3, 4, 5. Okay, go. You know.
Yeah, go. You no, not you. You go first.
You first.
Yeah. What's your name again? Doesn't matter. Go win the room.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow, I just want to get his two fireballs cast. Then we'll come. Yeah.
Exactly. So you know, I think like that wasn't the answer either, right? That's not making encounters more interesting. It's making them more grindy, which I think D&D has got to get away from. It's got to get away from the combat grind because the grind like will put me to sleep, honestly. It's like, I'm just like, okay, here we go again, you know? So it's got to get away from that, I think, a little bit. But
agreed.
Yeah. Well, you know, hopefully there's some good takeaways for you guys here, right? Like, check out this Monsters Know What They're Doing combat tactics, you know, for Dungeon Masters. Think about how to like make interesting encounters, right? One thing that I like doing as I kind of got better, especially like using Shadow the Demon Lord, is that I loved providing alternate options even in the middle of combat. You know, you remember that time, Jason, that we had that dryad tempt you with that medallion of power?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And I mean, that caused like severe party conflict in the middle of combat.
Oh yeah, I took it.
You know, yeah, exactly. And to the anger of some of our other players, right? And they're like, "We need to kill this lady."
Yeah, and I think using and this is something I heard a long time ago on a podcast, actually, which is great. Use non-combat skills in combat.
Yeah,
is a really good way to kind of break up the grind.
Yeah,
but yeah, it takes it takes creativity. Yeah,
yeah. So, So I think combat is kind of the low hanging fruit for D&D. Where like I think you can make this is like if you want to start making D&D great again, like relooking at combat. How do we make this a little bit more faster, more enjoyable, more varied, more interesting,
narrative focused?
Yeah, like that. I think if you do that, it would feel like a very different game and much more enjoyable game, in my opinion.
Agreed.
So check that out. And but we'd love to hear from you guys. Like, what did we get wrong here? Like, you know, is there something that we said that you absolutely disagree with, or is there something that we said that you totally agree with? Like, we'd love to hear your opinions. Leave them in the comments down below, or jump on our Discord and we can have even a full blown discussion with you about it. Cause I'd be interested to hear what you guys think about like D&D and if it does need to be fixed.
And still be friends.
And we can still be friends. That's right. So thank you everybody so much for listening to us tonight. We appreciate your support. We appreciate all the support you give us. And we appreciate those that are in our Discord and interact with us. It's always fun to see what other people are doing outside of my like immediate gaming bubble and thinking like, man, I wish I was playing with that guy. It's like, he's got an awesome table for Frostgrave, or he's got like an amazing, like, role-playing group set up. Like, wish I could play with those guys. So jump in, get some tips, get some tricks, get some ideas for you and your gaming buddies. But we appreciate the support. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll see you all at the tables. Have a good night.
Later.